If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 145. I'm going to entitle this one the Corona Election, because that's the movie Matt and I are going to paint a picture of for what's going on in the world, not only of politics, but the world of technology right now. So there's actually two topics talk about today with my friend Matt.
Hello.
And of course I'm Chris. And one is this whole fear about the coronavirus, because it's affecting not just only the tech sector right now. It is affecting the
global markets.
The global markets and everything else. But the funny thing is what I'm seeing, and I'm hearing rumors, and you're reading things in EE Times and all this about with the coronavirus and them, you know, and the supply chains all wrapped around China, that we're essentially, you know, only getting, we're going to see a price increase of consumer electronics and computer parts and pieces and anything that we need. And since computers are in anything, that means a cost increase in anything except food, you know, from that perspective. So it's kind of interesting to think about, but I think that's more of what it is. It's more of a thought game than it is a real problem. I do think one of the things that it is a lightning rod or that industry in the Western world, in the United States and Europe, is going to have to take into effect is, you know, why is all of our supply chain wrapped around one specific area? Now, I'm not so naive, and this is one of the things where in conservative politics, I understand the want, because in the United States, almost everything is designed here, and it's always manufactured in Asia. You know, and President Trump has talked about bringing that home. You know, Apple's going to bring manufacturing back here, and we're getting the car companies to bring manufacturing back here. But I think the U.S. at this point is not, it's not that we're not capable of doing it, but it would take 10 to 15 years to change going back to that capability. One, I mean, just plants don't exist anymore. They've been torn down. I mean, look at, I don't even know how many years ago it's been since it's happened, but where Matt and I live, it was a big General Motors town. They were the number one employer outside of the U.S. federal government. And they shut a huge manufacturing facility down where they made a certain type of truck. And that was one of two plants worldwide that they made that truck at. And but because demand was down and, you know, the bailout happened... and it was not a Teamsters plant from a union perspective. They had an IUE, which is an electrical union. They were put on the chopping block as being closed down. And, you know, to a large degree, yeah, it kind of affected the economy, but not as bad as I would say, you know, if they were, I don't know.
The local economy?
Yeah.
I think it had a huge impact.
But
regionally, maybe not so much.
But regionally,
but
it did not.
It had a huge impact.
Yeah. But that being said, half that plant is gone. They tore it down. Actually, more than half that plant is gone. And they've had some other companies go in and take over the newer parts of that. I don't really want to call it a plant, because it was more like an industrial facility. It was several plants. And that all built this truck, but they've torn about 2/3 of it down. The engine plant is gone completely. It's just a big parking lot right now. And you know, the body plant and paint shop are about what's left. And that's Fuyao, I think, has a Chinese company, by the way, manufactures glass there for, you know, windshield glass, and I think they have about half a third to a half of the complex, and the rest of it, there's another couple small businesses in there, and the rest of it's empty. But that being said, you would think Fuyao would come in and they're bringing all these jobs. But the thing is we've automated a lot of that because it was things that were kind of made sense to automate. You know, you're dealing with glass manufacturing and extreme heat and tight tolerances for tempering glass and all this other things. And that's not a good place for people to be. And even before they left, General Motors, the union kind of forced General Motors to keep employees whose job was to supervise robots that had a less than 0.1% failure rate. And, you know, robots don't call in sick, and robots don't... I mean, it sounds heartless, but it's true. And that's where manufacturing is today. The reason China employs so many people, and the other thing is, the people that most Chinese high-end, so Foxconn and Quanta and these types of companies who make computer components and the iPhones and Quanta, between Quanta and Foxconn, they manufacture everything for Apple, HP, and Dell, the three biggest manufacturers in the world for computer systems. Those aren't line workers, like unskilled trades. Those are skilled trades. They're called industrial engineers, and they're trained to look for problems in the manufacturing process. And a lot of what they do is quality control. You don't have a lot of people who are just slapping pieces and parts together, because electronics today, that is not particularly at a large scale, that is not what electronics manufacturers do. Now, there are a fair amount of people who put the end pieces together, but they're not sitting there soldering logic boards and all that. That's all done via automation, you know. And if you listen to Tim Cook, now, in some respects, I think he's right. In some respects, I think he's wrong. The number of industrial engineers that are required for that type of manufacturing don't exist in the United States. I do believe that is true. Not that we couldn't, but we don't. The American dream is not to send kids to trade school. It is to send them to get a four-year liberal arts degree. And, you know, and that's what's encouraged. And that industrial engineering training is a trade school, you know. Now, are we getting closer to that? Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the whole MicroWorks thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're starting to see a push back, literally and figuratively, I guess, to trade schools and the very simple fact that a kid coming out of high school now has really three paths. He can join the military, he can go to college and wind up with a degree that he can't get a job in, or he can do trade school and actually make some bank.
Yeah.
Well, in a relatively short amount of time.
Exactly, and spend less time getting that training. You know, a two-year associate's degree in a specific trade is, for the most part, the better option of the three. You know, and we look at community colleges too. Part of that is just the economics of it. It's far cheaper for some reason to go to community college that is state run.
Well, and at least locally anyway,
yeah.
The community college experience, I think, is much more driven towards actual results in the real world economy versus what's happening at our four-year schools locally.
Yeah.
That seems to have their head in the clouds or nether regions.
Well, again, you know, even when you talk about hard sciences and engineering and all of that, you are still talking a liberal arts education. You know, that we went through it. You have the gen ed requirements. That's the liberal arts part. Don't get me wrong. Some of that is absolutely necessary to function higher in a higher status I don't want to say status, but higher job category, meaning that to move to that next step, you know, there's soft skills that you get out of a liberal arts degree that you don't get out of a technical education.
Sure. You know? If your goal in life is to be a doer, then yes, go do trade school and be a doer and make some money. Ultimately, though, there is still going to be a need for managers,
yeah,
organizers.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, typically, I don't like the term doer because there are plenty of college graduates who are doers. You know, they get stuff done. But yeah, it's the soft skills. It's the ability to document, ability to write. Typically, you know, particularly in engineering, you know, the higher level maths and things that are required to ensure that what you design is particularly at like mechanical engineering and civil engineering and architecture. You know, those things where you build a building or you build an embankment, it's not gonna the levee and New Orleans, it's not going to fall down.
No, what I mean by doer is literally somebody who will, the product of their labor is something tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, you can be an architect and you can design a building on paper, but and not to knock that, but at the end, you just have a piece of paper.
Correct. You oversee it, but you're not the one actually making sure that the concrete forms and the rebar.
Maybe builder is a better term than doer, but yeah. To me, it seems to speak to the people better to just call it that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's
semantics. And you know, we live in, so General Motors leaves, the U.S. government becomes the largest employer in the area.
It's probably taken 20, 30 years for healthcare to supplant General Motors.
Well, yeah, the other thing that
locally
that was already a business here, but it seems to have expanded too, is the aerospace industry.
Well, I kind of lump that in with the military and government work here.
I do and I don't, because there's a lot of commercial work that is part of it.
Agreed, mainly because
but
Dayton being the birthplace of aviation, we have a history here of civil aerospace, which.
Correct. It has taken time. I agree with you that, and I won't say just healthcare, logistics and healthcare have moved in. And they kind of go hand in hand too, because it's not, when we talk healthcare, it's not just the hospital systems. There are several companies here locally who design and manufacture diagnostic testing for medicine. And so they're the ones who drew in this logistics system, which now has become almost as big as healthcare in supplanting General Motors and taking up those jobs or providing those jobs in the region local area. But aerospace is still huge. But the funny thing about the aerospace is we went from the aerospace industry here locally went from being the guys who are, you know, the engineers designing it on paper and then building prototypes, to now we've gotten a lot of local manufacturing, and it's been interesting because the community college has had to support this, has changed part of their curriculum to now they have a huge industrial engineering program, and it's all around aviation technologies, but they're turning out industrial engineers who go in and they're making sure the manufacturing process is going smoothly for these products because they have very, very tight tolerances. They're doing QC, they have all of the hard skills necessary to operate, you know, these computer computer-operated CNC machines and the computer-operated milling machines and it's in some respect it's kind of exciting. On the other side of it, they're almost hidden. Almost nobody knows or recognizes that this revolution has happened here locally.
Well, a part of that, I think, comes back to the fact that our that our mayor is spending more time trying to take our guns away than actually touting the legitimate successes that our community has managed to engage upon, despite a lack of leadership.
Very true. Very true. But let's tie this back to the coronavirus thing. So I get the media, like, you know, is sensationalist to a large degree. Even with all the deaths and the infections in China, 74,000 in the Wuhan province alone, the only people who are dying of coronavirus are the same people who are at risk from dying of the flu virus. And so far this year, we've had many, many, many more flu deaths than we've had coronavirus deaths. Now, United States, that being said, we really have a very small amount of coronavirus infectees, but I expect that to kind of go up worldwide as, you know, as it spreads. But still, the fact that the news is all they talk about and sensationalize is that, you know, so and so died of, well, you know, these people were at risk already because they're under chemotherapy and they have already had severe respiratory illness, or, you know, things that would complicate.
It doesn't help when the Centers for Disease Control calls it a pandemic. And then doesn't define the word.
Yeah.
To
mitigate. But again, it's an election year.
Well,
CDC is trying to get budget, you know. They're playing to it.
Which, of course, is what it's always about. You always have to follow the money. But I think it really does a disservice.
Oh, I totally agree with you there.
I mean, there was a rush on breathing masks, which is...
They've already been proven that
are useless.
Or not effective.
So the whole thing has been, I think, media driven, as it always is, to blow something out of proportion in order to get eyeballs to screens.
Yep. No, I agree.
And it does no one any good.
Yeah.
And finding legitimate information is hard to do, which is amazing.
Well,
in the information age.
It is. And part of it is, you know, the Chinese government didn't want to say that they had a problem. So, you know.
Well, and then there's the whole bit of why they didn't want to say that they had a problem. And
yeah.
And I believe this to be true. They manufactured it.
Absolutely.
I think it was a bioweapon.
Well, and it may not have been a bioweapon that they were looking at from the coronavirus itself being the weapon, but it is probably a bioweapon and looking at the coronavirus being a delivery mechanism. And the fact that there's a Chinese government bioweapons lab right next to a fish market, you know.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's pretty, at least the circumstantial evidence is pretty damning.
I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said at the beginning, it's apparent, and we've known this ever since we started doing the current president has started the trade war with China. I mean,
Did he start it, or did he, or is, well, he actually engaged?
He's actually engaged in it. Let's put it that way. That's a good, better line, or better explanation is, you know, he actually started to fight back a little bit. And, you know, other than, I'll tell you, the only thing that has affected me, I mean, it's not like iPhones got more expensive or got any less expensive, or your MacBook Pros got more expensive or less expensive. Car and tractor batteries. They went from, they like quadrupled in price. Now, that being said, they're still the same crappy Chinese-made car and tractor batteries that don't last more than a year. That's why Tractor Supply and Walmart and everybody who sells these things have a one-year replacement warranty on what should last. I mean, you used to buy a battery, even a really good battery, a high-end battery, and they would last for years. I mean, you could have a battery in a car, and that car sit for 10 years, and the battery would still take a charge, hold a charge, and still have decent amperage and turn a car over. And now, if they sit for 6 months, the battery's dead. The cells die in it, and you have to go get it replaced. But they went from being like $34 a battery for like a car battery to $112 a battery. That's the only thing that I've noticed that's really been, at least affected me from the tariffs that have been levied. But I think the that was kind of the start of manufacturing in the United States and Europe and Canada, and looking at things and going, you know, maybe our supply chain is screwed up. I mean, it from a business perspective, the way they have it set up makes perfect sense. You design it here, you build the prototype, you go to China and have it manufactured, because it's cheaper to ship it across the sea than it is to ship the components across the sea and then do final assembly here.
My only criticism of that is business should take into account redundancy. And I don't think they are. I think right now it's so driven towards the bottom line that
I agree.
They've sacrificed redundancy for cheap labor and whatnot. Yeah. So I think the whole supply chain argument to me comes down to the fact of what happens when your chain breaks.
No, I agree with you. And my fear is this. So, there are other areas in the United States. There's two that come immediately to mind who are ripe for taking over supply chain for almost everything. Cheap consumer goods, which is where China started, and even high-end electronics manufacturing. India comes to mind. They have a population who is well educated.
Which let's briefly hit on the fact that President Trump just spent time in India, I believe specifically for this purpose. This trip was timed perfectly, along with what's happening in China.
Oh,
yeah. It was an opportunity for the president to tout America to India.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
And vice versa.
Yeah. But India is number one on my... They have a bigger population than even China. Very well educated. It wouldn't take much for them. And also, just like China, really low standard of regulations concerning labor and construction and everything else. To me, it wouldn't take much to see that shift. That India becomes a new center for manufacturing. The other place, which a lot of people don't see because they're not aware of what's going on, because frankly our news doesn't cover it, but Brazil is also another area that's ripe. Large population, not quite as well educated, but you know, there's that whole concept of that I think you would find is, I don't care if they're educated. I would rather train them to do what I want them to do than have a preconceived notion based on an education that they have. But Brazil is rife also for, and if moving to Brazil in some respects is preferable to moving to India, because you move to Brazil, now the logistics time is much, much shorter.
Well, and not only that, but I think that then provides employment opportunities to a population that has been desperately and illegally immigrating to the United States, they may stay where they're at and actually achieve economic prosperity.
And not only that, but that's even a bigger statecraft issue, because if I create economic prosperity and they have a shortage of workers, all these people who are trying to go north now will go to Brazil, keeps them out of our hair. You know, that way we don't have to build as big a wall.
Or as deep a wall.
Yeah. Well, what we need to figure out is how to get Canadians to want to go to Mexico. And then the Mexicans build the wall. Can you imagine Mexican poutine? Oaxaca cheese on top of... Just kidding.
See, and now I'm sorry I brought it up.
Well, it reminds me of a Sliders episode, so show how geeky I am. So there's a Sliders episode, you know, and I don't know if you are. I know you're familiar with it, Matt, but our listeners, I don't know if you're familiar with the TV show. It was a TV show. Jerry O'Connell starred in it. You know, Vern from Stand By Me. And he's kind of a genius, and he had created this device and lets them go to different dimensions. And the dimensions are all, it's very Star Trek-y in the concept of that there's all these alternate timelines, you know, where one thing is different. Well, in this one, everybody... the United States was so bad, everybody was trying to get into Canada, and Canada was the safe haven, you know. And and that kind of it just kind of struck me as when I thought about that. See, Canadians wanting to go to Mexico.
not to bring it back, but I think it's smarter for us, and I'm actually surprised that he went to India instead of Brazil. I think that's actually brilliant.
Well, I think largely there's a couple of issues that preclude Brazil being your first choice. I think if it were me, it would be a two-pronged approach. I'd be approaching both India and Brazil. That way I have two supply chains that are in globally different parts of the world.
Well, again, that's redundancy. But, yeah. That's strategic thinking.
Yes, but the issue with Brazil at the moment is the lack of education and the lack of the ability to deliver the education. That's something that companies who want to invest there, and don't get me wrong, Nintendo has actually been one of the ones who's invested there, because and Foxconn has invested there, knowing that they can't keep it, particularly with the rising standard of living and the rising costs in China. They know that they need to find new markets if they want to keep that cost low to build those items. And you know, and then you also have the, particularly like a country like China, or a Chinese company like Foxconn coming to Brazil, there's a huge cultural difference. You can't treat the Brazilians like you treat Chinese workers, you know. They're more than likely going to have a revolution and kick you out. Unlike Chinese or Southeast Asian folks, and a lot of that's culture, you know. So, well, I think we've kind of beaten that to death, and I want to move on to this other thing because it's kind of related. You posted an article, and it wasn't a real article. I would claim it's fake news, but I know you did it because you knew it would piss me off on Facebook. And it was Bill Gates claiming that we shouldn't be investing in solar and wind power. And there was nothing to it. I read the article. It was like a paragraph, and there was no meat to it. Didn't explain why. I Google searched other things to validate whether, and there's no other comments, you know, about it. So, again, fake news. But I knew what you were trying to do, because we've had this discussion many times about solar and wind versus our traditional, particularly in the United States, our traditional way of infrastructure for delivering particularly power.
So you brought up the key word, infrastructure. solar and wind works for the individual. It does not work large scale. It just doesn't. It just doesn't. It doesn't produce near enough to be effective for, say, large urban areas. I think it's perfect for rural areas, maybe even suburbs. But I think the greater the population that you have, the greater the power demands, the less likely you are to have the space, for one, to put together a large enough solar farm, for instance, to be productive. Now, I say that knowing that out in Preble County, they're doing just that.
Oh, they're doing it in Preble County. They're doing it in Claremont County and Cincinnati.
But again, let's take a look at how much energy is produced versus the demand for that energy. And whether, I'm not saying, you know, a drop in the bucket is still a drop in the bucket. Don't get me wrong. It adds to our, it adds to our grid, but I don't think it's the investment in it at this large a scale. The return on that investment is not sufficient.
So
unless you're talking private industry doing it with private dollars, be my guest. But when you start doing tax abatements and throwing government subsidies at it and all of that, it's just not worth it.
Well, it's like anything. When you throw a government subsidy at it, you're usually, I mean, I will, let's talk about this. So being a farmer, I have a couple, well, I had a neighbor who was an alpaca farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And on paper, being an alpaca farmer seemed like that's the place to be. But that was because the U.S. Department of Agriculture was giving you a huge subsidy to raise alpacas and produce alpaca fiber, which, wonderful fiber, you know, can be made into multiple things, in many ways superior to wool. But so they give all these farmers this subsidy, and I mean, it was a tremendous subsidy. This wasn't like the I'm paying you not grow crops in the 80s subsidies. This was better than that. I mean, like, you know, tax abatements that basically you weren't paying hardly any taxes at all. Plus, you know, getting monthly stipends to cover your costs. I mean, all kinds of things. But there was no market in the United States for alpaca fiber. And because there's no real market, I mean, other than the craft market and people, there was no way so you produced all this alpaca fiber and you couldn't sell it. It would sit on it. Or you would ship it to South America where they actually use alpaca fiber. But they grow alpacas in South America too. So not only were you selling it at a loss, you also had to ship it at a loss. Most of these programs like that, I agree, particularly around energy. But it very well can meet the energy demands. Now, there are some complaints, particularly about solar, because you have to have surface area. Solar works on surface area. So, you know, government programs are buying up large fields. I mean, and I'm not saying they're buying an acre or 10 acres. They're buying thousands of acres to build these solar farms to produce energy. Can they produce energy and meet the demand? Absolutely. Same thing with wind. There are some downsides to both solar and wind. One, they're...
What's the ecological impact of this stuff, too?
We move the ecological... That's one of the things I was going to talk about. Move the ecological impact around. You know, there's hazardous materials in solar panels. Is it as bad as they claim it is? No. Recycling is always an issue. That's why the industry pushed recycling back on the consumer instead of taking care of it at the the commercial level where it should be taken care of, because they just didn't want the responsibility of recycling all this stuff. And that's why today you now watch Rumpke or Waste Management on a bad day. They pick your recycling bin up and throw it in the back of their garbage truck and not the recycling truck, because they don't have room to recycle it anymore. Solar panels, I don't think, are as big a deal, because you're talking about glass, and you can recover glass and mercury. There is some environmental impact, just like with coal or nuclear or whatever. If you have a disaster, like, you know, a tornado came through, and you'd have some of that broken up and released back into the environment. I think the bigger part is the wind turbines. So evidently, and I haven't done a lot of research into this. My daughter is all over this, because that's kind of the specialty that she's going into in engineering, civil engineering, is environmental. That the turbine blades are not recycled. And so they're cutting them up and taking them to landfills where they just sit there. To me, that's more of an, sounds like there's a solution that hasn't been engineered yet. You know, can we pick something else? Can we change the shape of turbine blades? We know that the columnar turbines actually produce more energy than the propeller type turbines. And those last longer. The columnar turbines last longer. Why on an industrial scale are we building ones that look like big airplane propellers sticking out of the ground? I guess we want to make the earth spin faster so we could turn them on. I don't know. But on the flip side, it's been proven, particularly out west, in dense urban population areas like San Francisco, that a solar farm can produce enough energy to supply those needs.
So regionally, it makes sense for them to do so. But what works in Arizona isn't going to work in New York.
Yes and no. You may not use solar, but you might use hydraulic power. I mean, they're on the coast. Certainly wind is better on the coast as well.
What I'm getting at, though, is that we're still looking for that.
Yeah, but
we're still looking for that aha moment where we have that one solution that works for everybody, and we're never going to get there. Yeah. We still have to take the all of the above approach.
Yes and no. The bigger part is, and you touched on it, is, you know, I'm a big advocate of, we talk about energy independence, and we're talking about our national energy independence. You know, where we don't want to be beholden to Saudi Arabia and the Arab countries for our oil, or like in Europe, where their natural gas dependence is on Russia and the Ukraine. You know, they people want energy independence for nationally. I believe in personal energy independence. And you're right. Subdivisions, rural communities, being personally energy independent is, and that's the way I believe it would be much harder to do in a city, because in a city, people don't own their own property. That's the issue, is people don't own the property. People rent and lease the property. So how do you become personally energy independent?
And not only that, but even correct me if I'm wrong, but the footprint for being energy independent is larger than the space that your typical city dweller has available to them.
Well, I mean, if you're renting or leasing an apartment, you don't have rights to the roof access and things like that.
Saying you did,
yes, they could probably. I believe it's possible. And I do believe there are solutions that you could do, particularly in cities. Out west, it doesn't make as much sense for urban areas to do this, because they sprawl out as opposed to growing up. Whereas in the East Coast, cities grow up and become densely populated. Where you grow up, that makes, I think there are solutions where you could create, it still may not be individual energy independence, but you could, I think there's opportunities to get to the point where you could be building independent. Because part of our problem in the United States, one of the things that we talk about from a cybersecurity standpoint, is how vulnerable our infrastructure is. And that energy independence is part of it. You know, we have a major outage across the falls in Niagara, and it took down most of the East Coast. And I'm not talking about, it's happened multiple times. And it was where the first time it happened, it was just a lightning strike happened to hit a substation in the wrong spot. And it took down the East Coast. I mean, and when I say the East Coast, it took down a fair section of the Midwest. It just so happens that Southern Ohio did not get hit because we're on a separate grid or a separate regional grid than Northern Ohio. But I mean, from Cleveland all the way down to Columbus, the whole state was out of electricity.
But half of the state.
Well, half the state. And then
half the state, it doesn't matter.
And then it happened again in the early 2000s. I think it was 2003, 2004. We had something else happen. This one happened in Michigan, I believe, and it took down everything again, all the way through. And it was interesting because I was in Washington, D.C. on the day it happened, and D.C. didn't get hit just because they were on the old Dominion grid, but everything north, so, you know, Bethesda and Baltimore and everything north all the way to Chicago, no power. And everybody thought at the time it was an attack.
Well, I was going to say this, on the infrastructure. This one happened not too long after 9/11.
Correct.
I mean, it was like within a year.
It was a couple years.
Or two.
Yeah. I think it was around 2003.
It sounds about right.
And, you know, so. And the problem is, so that's those were physical issues, meaning that, you know, something happened and we had a failure or a weather event destroyed a piece of physical hardware that.
But again, this goes into the redundancy argument we had with supply chain. If you have built in sufficient redundancy, things like this don't happen. A singular event
but
doesn't cause a high level blackout like that.
That's the problem, though, is the power infrastructure, not only in the United States but worldwide, there's not a yes, it shouldn't have happened. You should have been able to have an automatic rerouting, and you might have had a more regional power outage, but the greater power outage shouldn't have happened. But the grid, one, is the infrastructure. It was built in such a haphazard way, because you're talking about some of this infrastructure was built at the turn of the century when they first started putting, and they didn't think about these things because,
well, why would you?
Why would you? And over time, yes, they've tried to build redundancy in it, but there were design decisions made that you can't easily overcome. And so the choice was made to, we'll continue down this path rather than fix it, because it costs much more to fix it than it is to continue down this path on the chance that we might have something happen. And those are decisions that are made in free market economies on a daily basis. It's kind of the same thing about, you know, do you pay for auto insurance on the off chance that you're going to get in a car accident?
Well, in most states, you don't have a choice anymore.
Well, no, but I mean, that's the same logical thinking, though. And that's part of the problem, too, is that because we've always done it, this is kind of funny. This is part of the problem I think the Democratic Party has, and largely the Republican Party, that the established parties in the United States have, which is, this is the way we've always done it, so this is the way we're going to do it. And there's a huge pushback on both sides, and I, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, it's part of why, if you don't like him or you love him, President Trump got put in office. People voted for somebody who was not the establishment, at least didn't appear to be the establishment. Because they know that the old way needs to move. And I'm not talking about changing the Constitution or anything else. This old way of politics is thinking of... we have a Professor Sean who's occasionally on the show. We actually record an entire episode because and we didn't air it because it got into an argument at the end, based upon the predication of why do we fund public schools the way we do? It's not the right way, you know, or why can't a city borrow money from this pot to this pot? You know, again, not because it's the right way to do it. The answer was, well, it's the way they do it. It's the way they've always done it. It's like, well,
in that case, you're down to having to have accountability.
But there's other ways to have accountability.
Then pass the law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, just because that's the way it is, and that same thought process is the exact same reason why there's no redundancy in a lot of the major infrastructure, which is it's harder to pass to make the change than it is to do it.
Well, but
which is
again, this is where I come back and say this is not government making these decisions anymore. That'd be a whole different thing. Not to say that there isn't government influence in it, because
there's
but
huge.
This is private business saying.
Well, it's also private monopoly.
Well, that's part.
And that's part of my big issue of energy independence, because who do I get to choose from? You know, there's this, like in Ohio, there's this faux choice. You can go to energy suppliers and they can offer you different money, but there's a carrier charge that you pay no matter what. And guess who the carrier is? Duke Energy. There's no other choice. I want energy from somebody else. I still pay Duke Energy. They handle the transactions for the other company. And it doesn't really, I've switched a couple times. It doesn't effectively change.
But again, I think what you're trying to get at is a disruptive technology that would empower an entrepreneur to start building infrastructure that actually leads to personal energy independence.
Correct.
And that will be revolutionary.
Well, I mean, okay, so, I mean, what would it fix that we have a problem with today? So, I'm not going to... We know that the infrastructure in many areas is way outdated. And I'm talking, in this case, electrical infrastructure. I don't know a good way unless you just want to use, you know, you drill a well. And I have three wells on my property. I could get off the county water and, you know, use my well water. And I use it for all my farm stuff. I don't use county water for to feed the livestock and things like that. I use one of the wells. But I think that's a much harder solution, because, you know, how are you going to collect water? Can you collect enough water that you need? But there are some issues with water, you know, like the aquifers that, you know, the local cities and townships, pull that water from, you know, how do they filter it? How do they purify it, you know, to make it potable for consumers. Now, some of them, you don't have to do it. It's natural, naturally filtered through limestone and layers of rock that you can get. But then you have to worry about supply. Where's the level of the water table? If in a drought condition, do you still have water in your well? You know, that kind of thing. But electricity makes a lot more sense. One, it's one that you definitely can do. But, as an individual, you can provide. I mean, everybody. A good example of here, when, and I forget what hurricane, I think it was Hurricane Ike. It came all the way up through the Gulf, came through Kentucky, and came through Ohio. And once it hit, got inbound, as they now call it a derecho, but it was still the hurricane. And the county I live in, we lost a third of all the trees in the county. Through Kentucky and Ohio, they had massive, massive power outages. And I'm talking for weeks. And part of that was because Duke Energy thought the hurricane was going to hit North Carolina, South Carolina. So they took all of our linemen from our state and the state of Kentucky and state of Tennessee, and they sent them to the East Coast, to North and South Carolina, and it didn't even hit. And then they couldn't get back because people couldn't get gasoline because gasoline pumps wouldn't work, all of that. And some people, myself included, had generators, and you know, we were able to save our food, but just look at the economic impact for all the people who didn't, and insurance had to pay to replace all the food and refrigerators and freezers and other hardships that were there. So it became, it's one of these things that economically is a stack of dominoes. If more people had been off grid, yeah, you would have had some individual houses that may have lost power, but you wouldn't have had a vast area. And then it also changes the dynamics of service, because and this is where the entrepreneurship comes in. It would be like hiring an electrician to come in. You know, oh, we had this storm, it broke 4 or 5 panels. I need you to come out, replace those panels, make sure the electricity is still working. But even those people, because the way personal solar systems work, an individual panel does not mean you're not generating electricity.
Right.
And even broken panels can generate some electricity. So again, there's a lot of upside thinking outside of this box. Now, are there regulatory issues? Yeah. So a lot of places require that if you have a structure that is deemed livable, meaning that it won't be condemned, it has to have electric access to the grid. We saw an issue with that with somebody who lived out rurally in Alabama, and they had a very nice solar system and powered their entire property off solar, and they had a well that was also powered off the solar system, and they condemned their property or their mobile home because it wasn't hooked to the grid. I mean, kind of stupid law, you know, particularly in today's state, but and particularly for the fact that we used to not have electricity not too long ago. You know, we're kind of, my generation is definitely spoiled, and my parents' generation was definitely spoiled, but my grandparents, electricity was hit or miss depending on where you lived. And, you know, it wasn't until the TVA really came in that the South, particularly rural South, got reliable electricity. Prior to that, and it's kind of funny if you watch shows like American Pickers and things like that, if you wanted a radio in your house and you lived out rurally in like Idaho or Iowa or Montana, you had to have a windmill with an electric generator that charged the batteries in your radio so that you were then connected to the world to get information, because only the big cities had power generation. So, and that would have been almost till World War II. So we're talking, it's really not been 60, 80 years that we've probably had reliable electrical service everywhere in the United States. And I don't want to call it reliable, because that was one of the things that irritated me about that article, was that he talked about it, solar and wind not being reliable. It is. It works the same way as our typical electrical generation, in that we generate electricity and then we find ways to store it.
I think what the reliability semantics boils down to, if you're running solar, what do you do on a cloudy day? If you're running wind, what do you do on a non-gusty day?
That's a misnomer. And so wind.
But again, you are talking about a storage problem and not a generation problem.
Correct. And all of those systems, even when we generate.
But again, though, that works at the individual level. It does not work collectively.
I would, if you go to Northern Europe, they will argue with you all day, and I would have to agree with them. That it does work at a, they, Norway and Sweden have huge solar and wind, and they also use hydroelectric generation because they're, you know, they're all
but
on.
But again,
the ocean.
they have built-in redundancies. When we start talking about relying on solar, that's
well,
there's no,
let's look
there's
at this.
No redundancy.
So let's,
there.
Let's talk. Yes, there is. So if you generate more electricity than you use, and then you store that electricity. So say a day you don't generate as much electricity, you have a redundant stored energy to take up that slack. We do that on a grid-based system in Australia. They can't get, they have power outages and power surges all the time in Australia, up until the point where Elon Musk went out there with his power company and built a giant battery facility so that it could control the ebbs and flows and provide that redundancy. It is capable of doing it. We have the technology and the ability. And, you know, the trade-off from an environment, you know, people want to talk about environmental, you know, coal is coal. It's putting carbon dioxide in the air. You can't help it. Nuclear has its downsides. Although I would say nuclear, to a large degree, is safe unless you're the Japanese who cut corners. But then disposal of used fuel and nuclear is a big issue. And that's probably a bigger issue than carbon from coal and you know, what... And I mean, and we can also... There's the whole... Duke Energy had to pay out all that money from where one of their coal ponds, environmentally destroyed an entire ecosystem. And then the people who had to clean that up, they're paying millions of dollars out in medical claims because they didn't properly provide, you know, safety to clean that up, you know, for the people who were cleaning it up. There's always going to be environmental issues, and there are trade-offs. You know, we build solar panels, and there's mercury in solar panels, you know, and so a solar panel gets broken, or what happens when we have to wholesale rip out solar panels, and what do you do with them?
The problem is that everyone has their own preferred method, and there isn't a consensus. And until there is one, none of these alternative energy solutions are ever going to be implemented on a scale large enough to settle these arguments.
Again, I disagree with that statement, because just because we haven't done it here doesn't mean it hasn't been implemented. And you can't say that. A good portion of the state of Indiana's electrical power is coming from wind turbine generation. If you drive north from Indianapolis on I-65, you're going to see wind fields or wind power fields almost all the way up to Valparaiso.
Okay. Now, again, my that works great for Indiana, but outside of Indianapolis.
Okay, but see, you're looking at it as why? Okay, if coal works for everybody 90% of the time, why did we ever develop nuclear? Or why do we have coal if we could have nuclear?
Look, I'm not saying don't do it.
What I'm saying is, though, is that
when what works for Indiana is still not going to work for New York City. It just isn't. We have to have solutions that work for the area that we're trying to.
I agree, examine. But what I'm saying is that it's usually a combination of things. And yes, geographical area makes difference. Having hydroelectric power here in Ohio makes very little sense. The Ohio River is the only place we could generate it, and it doesn't have a big enough flow that we're going to generate enough to do much with. But on the East Coast, there's, and when I'm talking about hydroelectric, I'm not talking about dams. There are so many other ways to generate electricity. Like in the Scandinavian countries, they have these generators that float, and we actually have started implementing them in on the West Coast in the United States. But they float, and where the waves come in and the tides come in and out, they move this rocker arm up and down, and that creates mechanical force, which then spins a generator, which then creates electricity. The other issue that we have, and what we never address from a technology perspective in the United States, is almost everything we use in our homes today uses direct current. Computers, your phone, your television, your DVD player, exceptions usually or typically are like your stove and your air conditioning unit. But even those, there's a lot of AC. And what we do is the power wart that you have on any device is really what's called a rectifier. And it converts AC energy to DC energy to run your product. Now, the problem with DC is, and the reason we have alternating current instead of direct current for everything in your house, is because DC does not transmit far on power lines. Where AC, we can propagate it for miles and miles and miles over power lines. But that being said, why, and that whole issue of rectification, that's why the power warts get hot, is because there's energy loss in that conversion. And it's not a little bit of energy loss, it's a lot when you add it all up and everything that you have. And they've known this, particularly in the world I live in, the data center world. A lot of commercial data centers are DC, and what they do is they bring the power in to these massive rectifiers, which are a lot more efficient than the little warts that you plug in the wall, and everything in the data center runs on DC power because there's less heat generated, it's more power efficient, and everything else. Well, one of the things solar would bring, solar, wind, or whatever, on a personal independence level, because I don't have to transmit for miles, is I would be able to convert a lot of that energy loss and become much more efficient by keeping everything DC. Because that's, you know, we talked about it and it's kind of funny, but CFLs and LED light bulbs, you know, which all the power companies are telling you to switch to, those are DC. The part that, you know, screws in, that looks like the little, that's white on all of those, that's your rectifier that's converting AC power to DC power. And that's part of the problem too. It would make more sense for you to have a single rectifier at your house, and if the power came in off the pole to that single rectifier and then converted everything to DC, and like this apartment building that we're recording in right now, the whole building could be on a single rectifier. I mean, the whole building is already on a single AC connection coming into the building. So it's not like we're worrying about redundancy in that respect. You know, and it's one of these things that kind of, like I said before, it's a domino effect. There's all these things that could be much better, but we have to change this one fundamental thing to start that domino effect going on. It's kind of like the argument about electric vehicles and, you know, and charging stations and all this other stuff. And so, actually, I'm pretty impressed. There's a app called PlugBug, and you can put in, and it GPS locate your, if you let it have access, it'll GPS locate where you're at. It'll show you where all the electrical charging stations for cars are, where you're at. And I'm sure there are areas that we would call electric car deserts where there's no place to charge them. But the you know, the idea that we shouldn't use electric cars is not stopping the industry from moving that way. Not because in some respects it's still not a good idea, but in other respects it's a great idea, you know. But again, like anything, there's the trade-off, you know. Where are our environmental hazards in manufacturing and recycling? Well, they're different, you know. I don't have to worry about motor oil and gasoline and you know, all the corrosive things that are in a combustion engine, but I do have to worry about lead, mercury, and the things that are in the batteries and things like that.
But I think, though, the conversation needs to be had, and it needs to be had from a perspective of transparency of these problems.
I agree.
I don't think...
Well, you know that going back to the infrastructure thing, the issue is that it's the individual fighting the corporation. Know, these monopolistic corporations, and they're not monopolies just because the company is a monopoly. They're monopolies because your state, local, and federal regulation allow them to be monopolies. It's the same thing with cable companies.
And typically that comes down to who gets paid off.
Exactly.
Again, follow the money.
But that's, you know, a lot of the legislation around infrastructure is not geared for the consumer. It is geared for the
as it often is.
Yeah.
Well, and again, that's because as individuals, we don't have, we don't collectively express our power.
Well,
whereas a company does. And I don't mean power as in energy, I mean as in political power.
Correct. Because companies, you know, and that's the trade-off for capitalistic economic system.
It is.
Which is it's always the individual battling the...
Which is why we have the rise of the regulatory state.
Correct.
You know, it's a check and balance, which is quintessential American trait. Is, you know, if you have something that's powerful, you have to have something else that balances that power.
Yep.
And sometimes that leaves you and me on the outside looking in.
Yes.
And far more often than I think.
Well, that goes down to what the framers of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, it was a country of the people, by the people, for the people. And now it's become, because we have this regulatory state, it's not for the people, it's for the corporation or for the government itself.
We've had to make decisions, and we empowered people to make those decisions, and it's taken on a life of its own.
Yeah, well, I think we empowered people who shouldn't have been empowered.
Well, I keep saying, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, our founding fathers would be fathering some founding by now if they were around today. But here we are.
Except it wouldn't be tea they'd be pouring in Boston Harbor, it'd be kombucha.
I think it'd be paper, as in the tax code.
Yeah. Very true. Well, I think that's about it. I mean, we could beat this a little bit farther. But, and let us know what you think, our listeners. Send us some feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Because we definitely want to hear your opinion. Or if you want us to elaborate on some of these things, we'll be happy to elaborate farther. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.